Okay, everybody, this is Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can go to Facebook, type in The Matthew Aaron Show, click like. You can join us there. If you want to catch up on any of our previous 285 podcasts with some of the biggest guests in Hollywood and New York and in Chicago, all around, you can do so at Spotify or Apple Podcasts. But Spotify has been doing really great numbers for us lately. Today, I'm really excited. One, I'm being joined by one of my closest friends, Drew Saragusa. Drew, do you want to say hello?
Hello. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Fan Base Press comic. You guys do Fan Base Press, of course. And also is one of the... He runs a comic book shop in L.A., basically. I mean, he's Mr. Yes. Comics.
Collector's Paradise. Yeah.
Collector's Paradise in Pasadena, yeah. And which I was just about to visit, but then this happened, and here we are, and hopefully we are bringing you a lot of content, and if you're lonely, I hope we're keeping you company. I've never put out so many podcasts at a time, so thank you for hanging in there with me. I just want to make sure people have things to do, and today... I'm sitting down with someone who I wasn't even sure if he would do it. I'm so excited he's sitting down with us, which is Mr. Ethan Sachs, who is an NBC News correspondent, journalist, but also very famous comic book writer, it turns out. And we're gonna get into all that. But Ethan, how are you?
I'm doing well. And how are you doing?
I'm getting by. I'm doing the best I can, and I hope for everyone else they're doing the best they can. And once again, I've said this on previous episodes, but if you know anyone needs anything, don't be shy about reaching out, even if it's just to talk, whatever. And I know Drew feels the same way. We need to be here for each other during this crisis. And so, thank you, Ethan, for joining us. Ethan, I'm so excited to talk about this, and I know I've said I'm so excited so many times, so I really am, because you've kind of lived the dream career for writers, and I kind of want to get into that. How did you start out as a writer? What, like, take us to the beginning, because I'm very curious the trajectory of your career.
The not-so-secret origin story, if you will.
Yes, please.
So basically, I spent 20 years at the New York Daily News as a reporter and editor. Towards the end, I would say the latter half of that, I was mostly an entertainment reporter and covered movies. But also, I had a geek beat. So everything from comic books to Star Wars to Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, Lost, that kind of thing. And... you know, I knew a lot of people in the comic book industry because I covered it for so many years. And then the way the comic book thing happened was one of my good friends is Joe Quesada.
Wow.
And we were at a Mets game, and I had this idea for a comic book that I just thought was silly and kind of fun. And I don't know why, but I was like, hey, do you mind if I write a spec scripts? If you use it, I'll like donate the money to charity or something. I just think it's a funny idea. And he said, sure. But the way he said it, I could tell he didn't really want to cross the streams. And so anyway, I sent it in. And then the inspiration for it was I had done this story for May the 4th. It was in 2016. And that's the sort of Star Wars internet holiday.
Yeah, May
and
the 4th.
I had you guys celebrate it, I take it? Like,
yes, yes, it's a big deal. May the 4th is Star Wars Day now. So your idea is centered around that?
Well, so I had done an interview for an online daily news story, and I had interviewed the actor who played Greedo. There were a couple, there was a stand-in, but also an actor who actually played Greedo, in A New Hope. Paul Blake was the guy's name. And anyway, so he was a very funny guy, but during the course of this interview, we talked about how, you know, there was a whole generation that thought Greedo shot first and somehow missed
Oh, wow.
From across a pretty small table. And then, but I was old enough to have seen the original in the theater in 4 year old in 1977. And a few times, many times afterwards, seeing, you know, solo shooting first.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just, you know, I mean, it's this whole debate, obviously. So he went on this whole, like, joke about this whole routine about how I understand, like, he's myopic with those eyes, but when he's in the wrong business, if he couldn't hit, you know, the guy from across the table. And he sent in the script that says solo shoots alien and all this. So I was just thinking what the murder investigation looked like. so anyway, that was the, I don't know if you know Rashomon, Japanese story.
Yeah.
That was made into a Kurosawa movie. So it was kind of like that.
Even back to Star Wars, a little bit of Last Jedi pulled from that, having the different storylines not completely matching up and having to piece together yourself.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you know, Lucas originally was inspired a lot by Kurosawa
right.
Yeah. So Rashomon is one of my favorite Kurosawa movies. So I thought it'd be kind of funny to do a murder investigation that way. Anyway, I didn't hear anything from Joe for like 4 months. And then eventually I get an email. My wife is Japanese and my in-laws live in Japan. And so in September of that year, 2016, we went to Japan to visit them. And the flight is landing. I turned my phone back on. I'm coming back to New York and I get the email that changed my life. And it was basically Joe saying, I think you could do this as a career. They ended up not publishing that story for whatever reason. But it ended up that in November of that 2016, the Daily News was doing, you know, every so often would do layoffs. And it was, you know, it's bad to be a journalist in your early 40s at that time. So I was, you know, all of a sudden they announced buyouts. So yeah. Because I'd been there 20 years, it was like 7 months pay. So I was like, if I'm going to try a career change, this is my opportunity. So I took it, long story short. And then ever since, I've been scrambling to prove that it's a career change and not a midlife crisis gone to hell.
Now, so this is great. I just want to clarify. So how did you become friends with Joe Quesada?
Well, I've known him for much of that 20 years. In fact, like my first big entertainment story was, I think it was in 2001, back when Bill Gemmis was publisher and Joe Quesada was editor-in-chief of Marvel. And they like, literally they, you know, especially Joe is so responsible for, or is one of the major people responsible for bringing Marvel, you know, from this bankrupt company to this creative, just renaissance. So, you know, I covered a lot of that back then, and I got to know him a bit. And then I did a story for Wizard Magazine, which, for those of you too young to remember, was sort of like the preeminent, like, pop culture magazine for comic book fans. And I did, like, a day-in-life story for them where I just basically trailed Joe for a day. Just like as I got to know him, you know, he's been a good friend and, you know, I never normally would have done like in any way, shape or form sort of cross streams, but,
sure.
I just thought the idea was funny.
You had a great, funny idea.
I kind of thought comic books were made by like Keebler elves in a tree. Like I didn't think it was a real job, you know, it's like, oh, I want to be an astronaut or I want to write comics. It's just like not a real job, you know?
Yeah.
And honestly, it probably isn't a real job. It still seems like a weird thing to be doing for a living.
Did you ever find out? No, it's fine. I'm just curious. Did you ever find out? You talk about that day where you step off the plane, you're in Japan, you get the email from Joe. Did you ever find out what got Joe to finally, after 4 months, read your spec comic?
Yeah, he told me he was kind of, it was not like a rush thing. I mean, he's a busy guy to begin
sure.
with. Also, I think he's like, you know, honestly, I thought it was probably not going to be very good. And then we kept having a tough conversation. So it's kind of like not really in a rush to do it. So anyway, I owe everything to him to like once he liked the script. He put me in touch with Axel Alonso, and was the editor-in-chief at the time. And Axel brought me in. It was, you know, like, here, I'd like you to come up with a list of things you think you could write. And then, you know, we'll see from there. And then from there, it took months and months. But then they gave me like an 8-page story. My first 8-page story was for an anthology series off of Secret Empire, which was their crossover that year. And it was on the Daily Bugle. They figured, I guess, you know, journalists could write that. And then, oddly, a few months later, Mark Basso, the editor for Old Man Hawkeye, said, hey, I read your Greedo script, and I think we want to do this project called Old Man Hawkeye, you know. You know, they were putting it out to other writers as well, but he offered me the chance to pitch for it. And so that was my real big break was Old Man Hawkeye.
Wow. Yeah. We're going to get to that. I'm also curious, though, you've stayed very relevant in the news industry and in the journalism game. Is that because you're able to do both, so you'd like to do both? You still have a passion for doing journalism then, I take it? Because, for instance, you did a piece about social distancing having an effect on people with depression, and that was the first time for me that I became very wise to, oh my God, we got to be thinking about others too, which is another reason I keep doing this podcast as much as I'm doing it during the quarantine. So what is your passion when it comes to journalism at the moment?
Well, it's twofold. Number one, I've always believed strongly in journalism. Most people who go into that business, it's not a particular moneymaker. It is a tough profession, especially now where it's shrinking and there are more layoffs every year. Certainly, you know, given the political climate in the country,
yeah,
it's certainly not as respected as it once was by a large chunk of this country. You know, from the days where everyone would, you know, gather around their TV sets to listen to Walter Cronkite, and all Americans, whether they were Republican or Democrat, would respect that font of information kind of thing. So people who go into it really do believe that it's a calling and it's an important part of the democracy. So I've never lost that. It's just, you know, to be honest, at the time, after doing 20 years in one place and a newspaper that was clearly financially struggling, I knew eventually I'm going to be laid off. It's going to be hard for me to find a job at that age. NBC, I just work at 1 to 2 days a week. I'm a freelancer. It's both like it allows me, it's a great place with just really smart and open and kind and responsible people. So it's a great change of pace, 1 or 2 days a week. I liked going into the newsroom before it was all remote for me. But also there's like the financial reality of being a freelancer, and that is I need, you know, I can't coast off of one Marvel comic and one, you know, Secret comic or another publisher that I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, and for like a creator owned thing, which is, you know, still negotiation. So like it's a nice little added income to keep the lights on.
No, absolutely. I understand that too. Drew and I were talking last year. Drew and I always have these like great talks when we're going for rides on the way to the movies, at dinner, whatever. And we were talking about on Facebook and Twitter about how I still have family members that are very, very right wing, and they believe in fake news, if you will, and all that. And Drew and I were just like, this is going to be like a red letter for journalists in this country. Do you get mail from people? Do you get do you ever feel attacked by any parts of the country, or is your safety's fine? It's just the fact that you're being disrespected as a writer.
I mean, honestly, I don't really cover politics.
Yeah.
There's a separate politics division, and I'm very open about my, you know, my leaning certainly away from this president, towards the left, shall we say. You know, would have been centrist probably in another time. But so I'm open about, and so I don't feel comfortable covering politics. And I don't, I'm not asked to. They have their own very experienced and respected, you know, political correspondents. So it's such a big newsroom that I'm more of a sort of
sure. But you know, what's like the longer, inside
weekend story type thing?
No, yeah. Absolutely. But what's like the since you're inside the journalism business, I guess a better way to put it is, what is the reaction? What do you guys talk about when? When people have attacked you guys as being fake news, or just when you read things that are just like false, just like people are posting false things about things that you guys have covered that are factual, your colleagues, is there, I guess I'm just really concerned for journalists, period. So I'm kind of wondering what it's like on the inside with this president in office right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that predates the current administration, but there's just been this shift where, you know, people can get the news where they want to get it. And so what happens is, you know, I just got into an argument with a friend of a friend who I forwarded them literally a video clip of the president talking. Yeah. I mean, it was from a press conference. It was on CNN, but there was no opinion or anything, literally just a video clip. And he refused to open. He said, it's fake because it's from CNN. And I was like, this is the president talking at a press conference. It's not fake. And so we couldn't even agree on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was basically we were arguing whether or not the president said that the coronavirus was a Democratic hoax, which he did on, I think it was February 28th.
Yes, he did. I had the same fight.
I could find the Fox News clip just as easily. It's just like, I was quickly looking, you know, I did a quick search and, and we couldn't agree on whether or not the president had said that.
Yes.
That was a...
A scary thing to be, that we're in this age known as the post-truth era, where, like, everyone just views facts as opinions, where it's like, no, I don't subscribe to that. And I don't know, from my perspective, there's so many times in history where I've looked, and I was like, oh, that's a really interesting era. I'm glad I didn't live during there. That's scary. And I just don't know... like our children and our children's children, like how they're going to look back at this era. And they're like, wait, he just said that and you didn't believe it. How is that? How did you do that? Like, how did you just accept that he didn't say that or did say this? Or it's mind blowing.
Well, and we had the same exact thing. My mom went for a walk with our former neighbors the other day, and they told her, my mom's like, he called it a Democratic hoax. And my mom's a Republican. And she won't even vote for him. But my ex-neighbors said, oh, no, they left things out of that video clip. And my mom's like, no, I saw it live. And I've seen the clip. There's no editing. And they're like, no, it's been edited.
Yeah.
And people really believe that. They really believe there's been editing done.
Because they want to believe it.
Yeah.
Because it's an easier, you know, thing to digest.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
No, well, all right. Well, that's depressing. Let's get back to the fun stuff here. So I'm
this
just
is why I'll never be invited on again.
No, you'll always be invited on. It's just me and Drew. We come from the same, like, we have the same opinions. We have the same views. I mean, I know, you know, I follow you on Facebook and I don't even get involved in a lot of your Facebook conversations because I'm just like, yes, I agree. I don't know what else to say.
Just so the people out there know, like, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, and those are sort of like my public, open to anyone things. But Facebook is sort of where I keep family and friends. And so, like, I'm not that vocal necessarily on Twitter or certainly not on Instagram.
Your Twitter is very comic friendly. It's more comic friendly, yes.
Yeah.
And big news.
Yeah, so that's basically like how I demarcate it. And like, Facebook is where I keep in touch, you know, with family and also like maybe vent a little bit.
Yeah.
Just, I, well, I figure most people on Twitter don't want to hear me go off too much on any, you know, anything that
you don't
want.
Not following you don't want to do that anyways on Twitter. That's it's bad news on Twitter. Yeah. Drew, I want
to wasteland.
Yeah, something we all are big fans of. At least Drew and I know we've talked about it. Is Old Man Hawkeye. I kind of want to get into that, but Drew is the expert, so I kind of want to let him take it away a little bit. Drew, can you touch base with us on Old Man Hawkeye?
Yeah, so for me, I don't know, because that's one of those that people may or may not know that you know, was spun off of the Old Man Logan and kind of this future dystopian world of Marvel, but like, how is that for you coming in where you're like, taking over someone's story and like still making it your own? Like, I don't know. That's one of those that seems very difficult. And for me, thinking of like, for people who are wanting to do that kind of work, what would you recommend for how to get used to like stepping into someone else's world, either this or like Star Wars, that's not yours, but you still want your voice in there?
Well, for starters, we have to remember, and I think it's important to put in perspective, that it's, Mark Miller and Steve McNiven created this incredible, rich, alternate, well, it's actually like possibly the real Marvel universe, but just in the future. But they created this incredibly rich backdrop. But at the same time, it belongs to Marvel. So like when an editor calls and said, we're going to do this, it's not like I came to them with the idea of revisiting that world, because it's their playground and their toys, and I was blessed to be able to come inside and play with them. But the other thing too is like, I think, you know, it's like Old Man Logan is this fun romp. It's just this fun, you know, like R-rated movie. I think it was not as like reverentially treated as say like Watchmen or something like that, where, you know, treading on the sacred ground is really, really scary. Like this is something where, you know, it's like a fun amusement park ride. Like I don't think there was mass resistance to the idea of revisiting it. I don't think
there's also something you said about once something is so old, then it suddenly gets that status of you can't tread on it.
Whereas
Old Man Logan wasn't so old. They just pulled it off from it for Logan, the movie. You know, so you're like, oh, it's still relevant now. It's not this time capsule from the past that you can't touch.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, like, and the thing was, it was just like a fun, over the top story. So, and I loved, you know, they said to me, we want to do a prequel. You know, for people who read Old Man Logan, they'll know why it had to be a prequel, you know, but concentrating on Hawkeye. And I loved that Hawkeye character. I've always loved Hawkeye. I love heroes who don't have the type of power. Like, I don't know that I could ever write Superman because it's just so he's always on the right side of the moral ledger, but also he has this power set that kind of makes it hard to put him in a position where you really believe he's in trouble. And hats off to the writers who do it, because like, you know, you look at Bendis and you look at the guys can do that. And like, that's a gift. I think I love these characters either without superpowers or with, you know, the type of superpowers that really can't prevent them from being killed. I loved about Hawkeye is like in any incarnation, whether you read, you know, the, Matt Fraction, whoever is like writing, you know, Matt Rosenberg more recent. Like when you read these depictions, you know, Kelly Thompson, like they're you wonder how
you know
he survives from the You also wonder how he survives from panel one to panel six on any given page. It's like that you can't imagine him like getting through the page, much less the issue. You know, so I love that about him. This is sort of, I felt like if there was any hero I could relate to, it's Hawkeye. You know, and also like looking at, you know, so I was asked to pitch something. And so rereading Old Man Logan for like the 1,000th time, it struck me, okay, like when you meet him, you find out two pieces of information that I think were really crucial, or three pieces of information. Like number one, he's blind, but he's incredibly competent. Right, like he's almost like Daredevil, with like he can like, he busts in to rescue his daughter, and he's like, you know, X number of feet from the sound of my voice, and he nails the guy with the arrow. You know, and he doesn't hesitate. He's like completely, you know, able to, is just complete badass. So obviously there was some period of adjustment, so I knew that. And number two, he just casually mentions that he was left alive, and it kind of bothered him. Like, he was just not considered that relevant a hero, you know? So I thought, well, where's the story there?
Yeah, that's a good, yeah, and, that's good.
Yeah, and then the other thing, too, is he kind of screwed up being a dad, you know what I mean? Like, he clearly has this connection, but she has serious issues with him. So, you know, as the father of a kid, I totally, like, related to that. So, you know, here are these things that are puzzle pieces I had to get in there.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I'm curious as one writer to another. Now, you write comics. I'll do stuff for TV and film, and with TV, there's a lot of the note taking process is kind of, I think, insane. I think a lot of people would be curious. What's the note taking process like over at Marvel for a comic book?
Well, you know, it depends on the editor, right? Some editors are more like, take the script with very few changes. I was blessed on my first major project to be with Mark Basso, who's my editor. And he is somebody who's like, he could teach one of those master classes in how to write comic books and how to structure comic books.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. In the very first issue of Old Man Hawkeye, there's a fight sequence where he fights this outlaw gang called the Madrox Gang. It's basically, you know, so at the end of it, he's killed all of them except for this one, one Madrox who is running away. And I had, my description was something like, it started with him, even though he's in the distance. And then I was describing like what was in the foreground. And his note back to me was like, this is not written in a way that makes sense to the artist. You have to realize that the script is art direction for the artist, and they don't know what's in your head. They're seeing this for the first time on this page. You have to start within the foreground, because that's sort of like where the eye is going to be concentrated. This was like this basic primer, and man, I took that note to heart. I have this document where I sort of keep, I call it my Code of Bushido, and I keep all these great notes like that I get from editors and things I learned from other writers and things like that, so that I try not to make the same mistake more than seven times.
You know what, though? As a writer, I can tell you, if seven times, you're good. If you only do a mistake seven times, you're not bad. You're not bad. I've been making the same one my whole life.
That kind of note was golden. Yeah. You know? That was golden. Yeah. So the note-taking process depends on the editors. I think the best editors, you understand the notes, they're fair.
Yeah.
And then they also listen to you when you have a disagreement about something. They're like, I really want to keep the scene. You know, there was another note, and even though this was an R-rated thing, it's like, okay, I had Hawkeye killing somebody, which was like tremendously graphic scene. And he's like, and his note was like, okay, I understand this is a graphic comic, but you can't have him do that. I mean, even though we've established that he killed people, he's not a serial killer. Like, he's still Hawkeye. There still has to be this grain in him. And he said, we can bend him, but we can't break him.
Mm.
Or we can bend the toy, but we can't break the toy. Because this is, you know, there's a history that comes with these Marvel characters, which I thought was a very good note, too. You know, sure, Wolverine can do it because that's his character is established from the beginning. But, you know, Hawkeye having the Savage thing was a little bit.
Well, that's a great note.
Like, Bullseye could do that.
No, that is a great note, though, because I know Drew and I've talked about before, and you brought up Superman, and they've made mistakes, I feel, in the past. And by the way, I totally agree with you. Superman's the toughest comic to probably write. Just because that character has so few weaknesses, it's hard to wrap a tail around him. So the people that can do it, they're so talented. Drew and I have, though, talked about,
I will say...
Yeah, go ahead, Drew.
When it comes to that, how to crack him, Mario Puzo did it in the first Superman movie, which is his weakness is his self-doubt.
Right.
And for me, like, anyone writing Superman, like, that should be his first weakness. Like, you should go from there and kind of, like, is the self-doubt. Am I doing what is right? Is this, you know, like, should I be, like, that is the weakness to focus on, as opposed to a physical one, which is easier said than done, but that's always my, like,
exactly.
That's what you need to focus on.
Yeah. It's harder to focus. Yes, you nailed it, Drew. It's harder to write Superman because his weaknesses are mental and not physical.
Yeah.
With Old Man Hawkeye, what I love about, first of all, I love the way they drew Hawkeye. I love the way that character looks. I love that you kind of compared him in a way to like Daredevil. I think that's a pretty apt comparison for how I felt about your series, and it was really good. But Drew, I was going to ask, or I was going to tell you, like, that's a great note, because we've seen DC do some things with Batman and Superman where Drew and I were like, mm-hmm. would they do that? Like, is that a thing they would do?
Even like Ethan was saying in Old Man Hawkeye, where it's like kind of alternate reality, kind of just like, you're, you know, there's not really definitely like it is the definitive one. But like when you're saying this is the definitive version, like, these things have to happen and these things can't happen. And then even in alternate ones, you can bend some of those things, you know, but don't, you know, there's certain things where you're like, it's no longer the same character. It's, you know,
now,
I don't know.
What's gotta be really cool for Ethan is if this wave of comic book movies never goes away, which would be great. We love that. So, but if it never goes away, Jeremy Renner doing Old Man Hawkeye in 20 years, that'll be pretty freaking cool, you know?
20 years of hard living.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That's
true. Jeremy may need a little makeup done and stuff, but you know what?
That's perfect for Hawkeye. Like, you know what I mean? That's perfect. That, like, you have the old grizzled Hawkeye? Sure. That's the way to go. He didn't age well. let him be rough.
Yeah. I was so jealous of Ethan last year and earlier this year, because for those that don't know, I think everyone knows Star Wars Galaxy Edge opened in Florida and in California at Disney World and Disneyland. And of course, Ethan wrote Star Wars Galaxy Edge. You got to go to the parks before I did. I think you went to the Florida one, right? Was that the one you went to?
I went to the Florida one twice. They flew me in twice.
They flew me in, he says. Oh my, this guy.
And the weirdest part of it is they flew me and an artist, Will Sliney.
Yeah.
They flew us in after the book came out. So it's like, it's not even like this was research or something. It was when the Orlando Park opened, we did some signings and we were like guests. I mean, it was just really was one of the highlights of my life.
I was super jealous. Tell us about the experience. All right. So they fly you in, give it to us. Let's have the best highlight of your life. I want to hear it.
Let me start with telling you a bit about this project.
Please.
Keeping in mind that I am a huge Star Wars fan, like many of us who are listening. My first full-fledged memory is as a four-year-old sitting in that theater in Times Square. It was a Lowe's theater in Times Square in the summer of 1977, next to my father, who passed away 25 years ago this year. But the memory is so vivid that I can still hear his voice. Like, that's how definitive an experience it was for me. I've gotten a chance over my career to interview George Lucas and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, and each of those interviews, I had this little Hammerhead action figure, my last remaining original Kenner action figure that was not sold off by my my mother at a yard sale without me knowing. So yeah, no one wanted to buy the Authorian, you know, for whatever reason. But anyway, so I would have it in my vest pocket when I went to interview George Lucas. That's how much I loved Star Wars.
Wow.
So keeping that in mind, I got the chance to write a couple of miniseries, now a full series, where I'm literally writing within the universe of Star Wars. I become 4 years old again every time I sit at the keyboard. So keeping that all in mind, the very first one that I got to do, after I did a 10-page Mace Windu story, I was assigned Galaxy's Edge. And the trick with that is It was set in this, you know, fictional world, the world of Batuu, the Black Spire outpost, that would actually exist in real life, but didn't yet exist when we were starting to write and draw, and Will Sliney's case, draw it. So Will Sliney, especially the artist, had the really tough task of getting it completely right, because literally a fan, by the time this stuff was coming out, could stand in the middle of the park and see everything he did wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not like you could hide behind it. It's not like, you know, I'm going to draw Asgard and, you know, good luck visiting Asgard and seeing everything that I didn't get right. Like, this would, it would be obvious what he did wrong. So we had concept art to go on, but it's still like, you know, concept art and things like that. You know, Lucasfilm and Imagineering were very good about like saying, oh no, actually it's a little bit, this has to be adjusted or things like that. So we got a lot of guidance, but it was a little bit scary because we had to set it in a place that would be real. But we didn't know exactly what it looked like. So that was kind of a challenge.
After, since you visited there after writing this, like you have, these, yes. You know, any of these things you write, you have this world in your head, even if it's not totally your own, it's Marvel, it's Star Wars, but like you have your idea of what this is. Is that weird stepping into Galaxy's Edge for real then when you're like, I'm in my own mind?
It's so weird. It's so weird to have stepped inside, especially Doc Ondor's store, which was like a major setting in the comic book. And it is literally like all the layouts and the finished pencils and the inks and the, you know, it just, it really was weird to see it three dimensional, you know.
It's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, that just the first time you see it, it's impossible not to instantly become like a squealing little kid.
I was just,
I don't care how professional you are. It's impossible.
Well, I've not been yet, but I assume I'm going to just start crying when so, I get, like, I just know that, like.
Oh, we got to go, Drew, because I've been, and I remember when I went, and this is no joke, the first, like, half hour, I'm like, I know this guy online, Ethan Sachs, this mother, he got to do this, he got to do that, he wrote about, oh, my God, I was so, but in, like, the best way, but I was so happy for you / jealous as a writer, and then I'm like, I remember one thing came into my head. This happens, and any writer that claims they don't do this is full of baloney. But that anytime we get jealous about someone, I go, ooh, but then he has to deal with the crazy Star Wars fans. He can have it. Because now, and the reason I say that is you're in an interesting scenario here where George Lucas created Star Wars, sells it off to Disney. So George Lucas used to tell people what is canon and what wasn't canon. And so when you're writing this series, this mini series, Galaxy's Edge or Bounty Hunters, do you ever get any feedback from people that is like, this isn't canon or this is canon? Does that matter to you? Are you just like, I just want to write some fun Star Wars stories?
Well, Star Wars is very unique because there is no other franchise, to my knowledge, where everything counts. So everything is
everything.
Canon.
Yeah.
From when,
right.
You know, from, especially when Disney bought it, before that, like the movies and the Clone Wars cartoons or the animated show are also canon, sort of, you know, but everything afterwards, every comic, every book, the theme park, the backstory of the theme park is canon.
Yeah.
The video game. And that's unique because like you think of, say the Marvel and DC movies, right? Like what happens in the comic book isn't directly tied to the movies. I mean, it's influenced, but it's different. Harry Potter, the same thing. Lord of the Rings, the same thing. But literally everything ties in. It's like they're all puzzle pieces to this incredibly large mosaic, right? And that is humbling, you know, because like I'm creating characters that now exist alongside characters created by George Lucas, you know, that I know and love since childhood and that millions and millions of people across generations love since their own childhoods. So that's unique about Star Wars. So everything that I write, that Charles Soule writes, that Greg Pak writes, that Alyssa Wong writes, like that's all canon.
Yeah.
The thing is like Lucasfilm, you know, is obviously if there's any mistakes, like they'll let us know because they, you know, they know the canon better than anyone. And so, so it's not like I can go rogue and like, I'll do a story where, you know, Darth Vader travels through time and he's alive again after Return of the Jedi. And you know what I mean? Like, I can't do that. I would be stopped somewhere along the way.
Do they ever give you, since you, I think Drew, you would probably agree, something so fascinating about this is you wrote it before you went to Galaxy's Edge. Do they give you notes on what Galaxy's Edge is going to be? Do they tell you what to include in your story? Like, what was the process like putting that together?
Do they give you kind of a blueprint? Or
right.
Do they let you go and then correct you later?
No. So they, for Galaxy's Edge in particular, they had like a creative Bible. It was really from Imagineering, which is the geniuses that, you know, build all the cool stuff in the parks. So like, you know, we had access to maps, to concept art, things like that. So it wasn't like we were completely
you weren't blind,
you know, for that one. Yeah, and for that one, the thing is too, they were doing simultaneously to the comics some great novels, you know, by like Delilah Dawson, wrote a Black Spire novel, things like that. So I knew that my main character would have to be Doc Ondar, who is this sort of proprietor of these of Den of Antiquities with all these rare items from all over the galaxy. So the original idea was that it would be almost like an anthology where there'd be like a separate story for, you know, several items in a store. But then I felt like I wanted to make it more than an anthology and have like sort of a central story that arced its way through. So then it became kind of a heist story. And Will Solani, the artist, and I created like this gang of three criminals that basically sort of tie it all together.
Yeah, it's great.
So anyway, that was the... It was sort of a combination of my idea, of Will Slaney's input, but also within the context of us, you know, looking into this particular part of the park.
Yeah, I mean, Drew, I'm going to let you take it from here, but just for me, the coolest thing I noticed as someone who's written, and, you know, when you get a film out and you see it on Amazon Prime, there's this, like, big, huge burst of pride. And Ethan got to do this comic. You've done a ton of comic books. And when you first see it in a comic book store, that's got to be awesome. But the fact that I left Galaxy's Edge and went into the Star Wars shop and saw your comic book in Disneyland, in the Star Wars shop, I'm like, that is the Mecca. Like, you've reached the Mecca. That is it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty, I've been blessed, you know. It's definitely getting that the very first issue of Allegiance was the next Star Wars series I did. When you open it, it has like sort of the first page. This was the moment where I reverted into a total fanboy. The first page has like the open crawl as if it were a movie.
Yeah.
You know? And then you open it, and page 2-3 is just the Star Wars logo, just this giant Star Wars logo. So it really kind of mimics the feel of the movie, if you can picture it. And when I opened that from the first page to the page 2-3, it's all the Star Wars logo. I literally had the music in my head.
Oh,
like,
man.
The theme, the Star Wars, the John Williams score just played in my head.
That's so awesome.
Like, it was like Pavlov's dogs. Giant logo. My mind filled the rest. And like, I can't even tell you, that was probably the most emotional moment for me, was when I had that physical copy in my hand. Because a lot of times, like, they'll send you, here's the layouts, here's the art with the inks, you know, here's the art with the colorist. And so you're seeing it piecemeal come together.
Yeah.
But when I got that physical copy in my hand and then I could see how it laid out with that opening, that's where it just was like an emotional, you know,
that's
like being
so awesome.
French kissed by an angel. I don't know how else to describe it.
That's so great. Drew, why don't you take it away? What do you got?
So I guess, you know, back to your journal background and everything. So, you know, you have this idea, like, you know, when you're pitching to your editor or your editor is telling you, and then it goes from there and you're writing it, getting notes on that, like that process, have you learned a lot from that in translating it into your comic book writing? Like, is there a lot of crossover there? Is it different? Has that helped you? Because a lot of times creatives are like, I'm doing my story, and they don't like to be told not to do this. But in journalism, you're constantly told you can do this, yeah, you can do that, you know, like, yeah.
Do you think, like, the things that helped me the most from journalism into transitioning to comic book writing were a few things. Like, I mean, the most obvious one is I covered comics for so long, so I've read a fair amount of scripts. So I could reverse engineer what I liked and didn't like. It wasn't like I was new to this completely. Yeah. So that helped me. But it's specifically, like, skills from journalism or things I learned from journalism, speed and deadlines. Like, I don't miss deadlines. I have a fear of missing deadlines, which I think my editors, my new editors, appreciate greatly. I know not everyone in the comics is like that. You know, so I that is something that is definitely carried over from journalism. I think I guess brevity, because, you know, I didn't write for the New York Times. I wrote for the New York Daily News, where, you know, the articles were much shorter. You had to get to the point quicker, things like that. I think I try to do, you know, I try not to overwrite dialogue or a scene. I mean, maybe I do. I'm sure there might be people who think I do anyway, but I do think that that's helped, is like maybe show more and tell less. You know, the great thing about comics is it's a visual medium, and let the artist tell a lot of the stories. So I try not to junk it up with too much exposition. So that's like stuff that I think journalism background helped me. By the way, sorry, I live in a Manhattan apartment that's pretty small with a wife and a kid. So if you hear background noise,
no, I haven't, and it's no big deal.
I mean,
I have a kid in this house, and unfortunately, Drew is alone. We should be doing this together. I'm like, oh, it's so weird, him and I doing it on the phone. But man, I could talk about this all day. It's just like so cool to me. Have you been approached at all? Is there been any talks at all about maybe doing different kinds of writing for these universes, whether it be TV or film?
Not to TV and film. I mean, I'm just like a little bit more than two years into a comic book career. So I definitely have a lot to learn, and I love, you know, the thing is too, like, you know, with the journalism, I don't have like a lot of free time to sort of poke around. I do have something I'm working on that's a creator owned, but it's very early, and there's nothing that can be announced soon, but I have a really cool artist who I worked with once before. I'm really excited about it. You know, assuming it doesn't collapse.
More too, to be able to do your own thing for, you know, like, and there's not the Bibles being handed down to you of this is, you know, the character, you can't break them because they're yours.
I love both scenarios.
Yeah.
I love both scenarios because, like, Star Wars, I will never get tired of writing Star Wars or Marvel characters that I love.
Yeah.
You know, I also did a series for Dynamite called Kiss Zombies, which is exact, whatever's in your head is exactly what it is. I things like that are fun. I'm doing something for another publisher right now, which may be on hold a little bit. I'm not sure because of the current situation. But anyway, I'm fine with all that. This is a very personal story, you know, even though it's sort of a horror fantasy, but there's like the background behind it is really personal. That one I'm definitely really, really excited about.
Is there anything, because I know Allegiance ended last year, right? At the end of, okay, so... And I think we're all caught up then. Is there anything upcoming that's supposed to come out that you have?
Bounty Hunters is still going.
Yeah.
It is an ongoing. You know, unfortunately, so the first two issues came out, and then the third issue was supposed to come out Wednesday. But, you know, obviously current events.
Yeah,
in the scheme of everything that's going on, that's not the biggest crisis out there. But you know, uh, I
I don't have an ETA as to sort of when,
okay,
you know, copies can be in people's hands. So, you know, but it's an ongoing, it will continue. That has been fun because the point of view character, it's a lot of the great bounty hunters that we all love, the Boba Fett's, Bosks, and maybe a few others, in the not too distant future. But the point of view character is this character Valance, who longtime Marvel Star Wars readers may remember way back from 1978. He's a cyborg, and I've had some snide remarks on social media where it's like, oh yeah, you guys ripped off the Terminator. So I'll have you know that character plays the Terminator by like 6 years. So who ripped off who? James Cameron. He's not the Terminator. He's a much different character. So that's been fun to write because that's like a segment of the Star Wars universe that's kind of gritty and about crime. It's basically the denizens that don't really care who wins between the Empire and the Rebellion. Like they're just not even, you know, they've got bigger issues just surviving and however they do.
Is it difficult writing bounty hunters when, you know, your age demographic has got to be like 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds? I'm imagining they want at least these to be somewhat kid friendly while being adult friendly, kind of like a Pixar movie or something. Where is it difficult to write a graphic novel like or a series like Bounty Hunters, where you maybe want to, you know, have a little more of an action packed scene and you got to hold back or anything along those lines?
Well, you know, honestly, I think it's written a little bit older than 8 because I feel like the comics, it's probably, you know, more like teens and 20s and, you know, through adulthood. So like, I don't think, there are younger Star Wars comics out there.
They do differentiate too. So with the Star Wars comics, Marvel releases through IDW, the Star Wars Adventures, and those are the ones aimed at younger audiences. And then the ones that are actually put out by, you know, Marvel are usually aimed at like a PG-13.
Okay, so that's why.
Exactly. PG-13 is a good metric.
Great.
You know, it's kind of a little bit like the Marvel movies. And actually, Bill Gemmis, when I first interviewed him in 2001, he said something that's really stuck with me. It's also in my code of Bushido. And that is, if you aim for like a smart 14 and 15-year-old, you'll get everybody.
Yeah,
because like if you can land, like you think of the Marvel movies, like a smart 15-year-old totally gets it and enjoys it, and if it lands with them, you're gonna get all the way through their parents. They're also gonna appreciate it for the same reasons. Like you don't talk down to the audience. You don't, like, if you can land that way, you're gonna get like a wide audience.
Yeah, that's,
and I always thought that's when I write, that's what I try. With the exception of Old Man Hawk, I was a little older. Old Man Quill was a little older, but like for the Star Wars, I aim for like a smart 14, 15 year old.
That's how I feel.
13 to 15, and then
that's how I feel you do for the Pixar movies too. That was why my comparison was the Pixar, because I feel like I haven't gotten a chance to read Bounty Hunters yet, but like Allegiance and Galaxy's Edge, I felt like, boy, these are really good, but I actually wouldn't mind if my 8-year-old looked at them. Like, I wouldn't mind if I read them to him and he went through them or whatever. So it's interesting that balance, but you're right. It's just like, write really great material, period, and, you know, it doesn't have to leave out anybody. Drew, do you got anything else for Ethan? We've taken up an hour of his time, and I feel awful. So I didn't know I'd have so many questions.
For me, I was thinking of, like, I mean, you have with Old Man Hawkeye and Old Man Quill and, like, the Star Wars Bounty Hunters, there's this kind of thread of, like, the old gunslinger in the Western. Mm. That, like, a character you really gravitate towards, or it just ended up being that's what you're writing for, or like, because you said, you know, you don't really relate as much to Superman, or is that your type?
I mean,
you really enjoy
it's sort of turned out that way, but I don't necessarily, like, I love the Westerns and that sort of Clint Eastwood type character, but I don't know if it was like anything intentional. Old Man Hawkeye kind of definitely had that Western you know, inspiration to it. And to a lesser extent, Old Man Quill, I guess, too. But that was more of a product of being loners in that wasteland.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think in the case of Bounty Hunters, it's probably just it really has more to do with the characters that I've been given. You know, they're certainly not social. You know, they're not bubbly social extroverts, or at least at this point in time.
They're not
when
your
we're
first
catching
choice
them.
To help you out. They're your last resort kind of people.
Yeah, yeah. So like, yeah. You know, I definitely like that about them, but I don't know that I. It's like my natural go-to or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Which one of the characters that you do enjoy more, though? Or like, what do you particularly enjoy to write or play with?
You know, they're I definitely think of the characters I've written, I felt closest to Hawkeye. You know, with Old Man Hawkeye. In terms of fun writing, some of the dynamic, like writing Han Solo was incredible for me. It was just a fun character to write, you know, in over his head. I mean, there was one page in Galaxy's Edge where they're out to like wrangle a Sarlacc, and they're supposed to meet an expert, and they're sort of double crossed, and they were like, "Hey, we sent you this thing about the didn't you read what we sent you?" They sent him about like the behaviors of Sarlacc, and he's like, I might have skimmed it. And you know, he didn't read it. Like, you know, he was like woefully unprepared for this thing.
He
like, you know, got himself in trouble. Yeah, it was just like you knew he was full of crap. And I kind of felt like that just felt to me something, you know, Harrison Ford's character would say, you know, from the movie.
Yeah,
it just felt to me like I'd seen the movie so many times, and I felt like I really could relate to that. And so just little things like that. I also managed to get Greedo in as a kind of badass in one of the issues. So that was brought
cool.
It full circle.
Well, I guess my final question for you, and then we'll let you go. Everyone's doing dinner now, I guess. My 8-year-old just came running down. But I find, you know, people say this to me all the time, but I've been doing it for 10 years, so I don't know anymore. For me, I can't remember how I got into TV and film. I just did. How do you get into writing for comics? Is there a way? Is there advice you can give to someone? Because obviously your story is unique to you. Is there advice to give to people about, like, this is what you need to do?
Well, I'd say... unfortunately, for most people, the hard answer is my way in was very unique because of the experience that I had as a journalist and the connections I made. You know, I was able to have someone at Marvel look at my stuff, but that's not most like spec scripts are not read for a very important legal reason, and that is they can't, because you know, if they have an idea that's similar to yours, you could end up suing them.
Yep.
So they won't read something that's unsolicited. So, and basically it's really tough for writers, because like with an artist, you can send a portfolio and they know exactly how you draw. You can show how you do something sequentially, but for writing, you sending in a script, like they want to see something finished. So the short answer is you have to find a way to, whether it's self-publishing, whether it's web comics, whether it's, doing something for an anthology where you actually have something finished that you can show. Like you look at all the, you know, like you look at Matt Rosenberg, one of my favorite and one of the best writers, and just an all around great guy in comics. You know, he started out writing independent kind of crime comics, and he got noticed by Marvel eventually. And it led, you know, to him getting X-Men and things like that. You know, so it's, you don't get X-Men just because you come up with the world's great, even if you think it's, you've come up with the world's greatest idea, there are several steps, unfortunately. And it's, so you have to start showing what you can do first. And and the only way to do that is to, you know, get to the stage where you're writing an independent comic, where you're doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or it could be an anthology story. You need basically to have a calling card to show what you can do.
Similar to film, you know? Where you do independent film, go make a movie, go, you know, put out your best work you can do on your own, and people will recognize you, or you'll now have, if you do get somebody's email at Comic-Con, you can send them your work. And what you're saying is just make some work of your own and at least have that in your, you know, your dossier so you can bring it around. And when you meet the right connections, that could help you out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately there's no shortcut. It's like
you can't apply for the job.
You're not going to get a Marvel movie until you have some movies that you can show that makes, you know, Marvel want to give you that $100 million movie, you know?
Yeah. Well, Ethan, thank you so, so much for doing this. I hope next time you have a series coming out, you'll come do it again. Drew and I'm speaking for Drew, but I'm assuming Drew had a blast too. Like I'm fanboying out.
Thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, I'm fanboying out. And if you're ever in LA, stop by Drew's comic book store. I'm sure you'll be a very popular guest.
Heard of it. And I know people that are, that have been there and have raved about it. So,
well, great.
We'll make sure next time I'm in LA, you know, hopefully, in the not too distant future,
hopefully,
that I will stop by and say hi.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much, Ethan. And, thank you, Drew. And, everybody be safe and healthy, and I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, man. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Bye.